Just the use of the word blood can capture the attention immediately. Blood is absolutely essential to life, but seeing it outside the body or hearing about it being outside the body is obviously often a sign of trouble. Today's guest has seen plenty of his own blood. He relates those tales early in his book. It's called Blood, the Stuff of Life, but the book is about much more than childhood accidents. It's a consideration of blood both as physical fluid and as powerful metaphor. And think about all the ways in which we use the term blood, like it's in the blood, you know, it's deep in the blood, all those sorts of things, all discussed in Blood, the Stuff of Life. Lawrence Hill is a former journalist with the Winnipeg Free Press and the Globe and Mail of Toronto, the author of 9 books, including this one, a mixture of novels and memoirs and more. Lawrence Hill, thank you for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So the book is actually a collection of, what, radio essays? Is that right? Would you explain that?
Well, the book is just a book of essays about blood, metaphorically and, of course, in the veins and arteries. And from the book, I culled five lectures, which were given across Canada and then were broadcast on national radio in Canada. So first came the book, and then essays and lectures were derived from them.
What was the starting point for giving such deep thought to the subject of blood for you?
Well, it's been a long-time obsession for me, Jeffrey, certainly, as you mentioned, from some childhood accidents when a lot of blood was spilled. On one occasion, as a child, I cut myself quite badly on the wrist by accident and was racing home to get the help of my mother and made a point of, even in my shock, bleeding over every single sidewalk panel, holding my wrist so it would splash blood over every sidewalk panel before I got home. And why would an 8-year-old child, even in such fear, be possessed to do such a thing? It seems a little silly in adolescent, but I think it was because I had the sense that this was some sacred fluid that was gushing out of me, so the least I could do if I was losing it was to mark the sidewalk with this sacred stuff. So since that time, and because of various other personal encounters with blood, I've come to meditate quite deeply on it as metaphor as well.
So I'm trying to figure out what was happening when you were a kid there in that accident with you. So really, it was like, this is cool. I'm bleeding.
Well, I was scared. I was bleeding quite profusely. I'd cut myself when I was on all fours playing hide-and-seek with some friends in a Toronto schoolyard. And so I was bleeding very profusely. And a child knows the difference between a little speck of blood, you know, from a hockey puck or something, and serious gushing blood. So I was quite worried. But even in my worry and in my fear, I had this idea to mark the sidewalk. You know, some children take advantage of wet cement and they carve their initials into it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a little bit like that, but better, because this was my blood. And I think that deep down what was going on is that I sensed that this fluid that was leaving my body was sacred. It was hot and fresh and red, and I didn't want to waste it, and I wanted to mark the sidewalk with it. It was sort of like leaving a side of my own life on the sidewalk. And, of course, I didn't think all that through when I was running home, but in retrospect, I think that's what was going on. I sensed deeply that this was a profoundly sacred stuff that was leaving my body.
And that, again, provides the impetus for the book then. So, I mean, you could have obviously stuck with just the physical properties of blood, but you went far beyond that and more into the social science of blood.
Yeah, so, well, I'm not a doctor or a hematologist or anything like that, and I certainly am happy to leave to the specialists a meticulous, you know, evaluation of all the physical properties of blood, although they do fascinate me. It's amazing how blood works in the body. You can lose up to 40% of it. You can give it over and over. How many body parts can you give over and over and know that those parts will essentially grow back? You could donate blood 1,000 times in your life if you wanted, and you'd still be fine. So how many times can you do that? We give it in a way that is purely philanthropic. And so the way blood works in the body is quite interesting. It can save us and it can betray us in so many ways. But I'm especially interested in how it plays out in our imaginations.
Absolutely. Chapter one is, though, about ideas about blood and changes over the years. And you start with the physical stuff. And, wow, 250 million red cells in a single drop.
Oh, yes. And, of course, I like to imagine all the different jobs that the blood parts have. And, of course, the white blood cells are often equated with being kind of like soldiers destroying enemy invaders. So there's a very military language that's associated with the job of the white blood cell. It's to attack foreign invaders. It's very militaristic. And then the platelets, of course, are the parts of the blood that fix you if you've been cut and help you coagulate and prevent the blood from leaking out of you. And so I liken platelets to sort of emergency room doctors or nurses who are sewing you up after you've been shot. But the red blood cell is the cell that I'm fondest of in my imagination, because of course it's the cell of love, because it kisses your tissues, you know, every instant with the gift of oxygen that's being transferred, of course, from your blood to your cells, and so that your muscles and so forth can do the work that they need to do. So that's sort of the it's a nonstop kisser, the red blood cell, because it's working so much, circulating so quickly to deliver oxygen everywhere. So I have a little bit of fun imagining metaphors for blood as they work in the body.
Lawrence, you're not just a prose writer, are you? There's a lot of poetry in what you're talking about here.
It's a good thing I'm not a poet, because I'm sure I'd be expelled from any poets' union or league if there were. But I suppose, like most people, I wrote a bit of very bad poetry as a teenager. Not quite good enough writer to be a poet, so I settled on being a novelist.
All right. Well, novelist and a nonfiction writer as well. The book is called Blood, the Stuff of Life. Lawrence Hill is its author and our guest. We'll come back and talk much more about blood, not just for its physical properties like the red cells and the plasma and all the other components of it, but for the importance we attach to blood as it pertains to civilizations and societies and all of that. Much more to talk about with Lawrence Hill and Blood, the Stuff of Life. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1:30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Lawrence Hill, Canadian journalist and author. His latest book is called Blood, the Stuff of Life, an examination of blood as both a physical and a metaphorical issue. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about blood that's important to bodies and societies. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Still in Chapter 1 here, Ideas About Blood and Changes Over the Years, you write, I imagine blood as the planet Earth. What do you mean by that, Lawrence?
What I meant by that, Jeffrey, was that blood tries to stay in a certain balance, and if something goes wrong, to throw it out of whack, say you ingest way too much sugar or something like that, or way too much alcohol, or do something to your blood that isn't good, then gravitational forces, I'm speaking metaphorically, will try to pull that blood back into a state of stability, back towards its typical ordinary balance. And so the blood does have an ability to repair itself when you've damaged it, say with too much alcohol or too much sugar or something like that. And so blood is kind of like gravity. It pulls forces back to their normal state if it can.
You take us through the things that we have stopped doing medically, like bloodletting. But as a side note here, we still use leeches?
Oh, yes. Well, bloodletting, of course, you know, is one of the most interesting practices to think about in terms of the spilling of blood, because it went on for thousands of years. For thousands of years, we in the West were governed by the idea, deeply seated belief, that the body was divided into four humors. There was black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. And the key to health was to keep those four humors, or four key parts of the body, in balance. And so it was profoundly believed for thousands of years that this cause of much sickness and ill health was having too much blood, having an imbalance of blood among the various humors. So the solution to serious illness or injury was to let blood out, to bloodlet, to restore the proper balance. So when you think about it, all sorts of people over the years died from, you know, aggressive bloodletting. George Washington himself died a day after a huge amount of blood was let from his veins to supposedly help him get over a cold. Mozart died after a very, very heavy bloodletting. Napoleon described medicine as the science of murderers. So people have been quite anxious about death and bloodletting for thousands of years, although we practiced it. But still today, there are some ways in which we let blood consciously. Of course, we let it in labs when we're having our blood tested. We let our blood flow to give blood to others. We use leeches, as you asked, Jeffrey, to promote circulation in small body parts like fingertips and toes and ears and so forth after surgery. So leeches help stimulate circulation and secrete an enzyme which promotes repair, you know, after surgery or in serious injury. And so we use bloodletting in certain ways. There are a few isolated medical conditions for which we still let blood, but they're quite rare. So yeah, there are some instances in which we still use bloodletting and leeches.
You're fairly gentle, though, with the concept of bloodletting, though, I noticed, because you get to the same place that I get about medicine. Was it in 100 years, I think people are going to turn back and go, oh, my God, what were they thinking, which is the way we're reacting to bloodletting.
Absolutely, Jeffrey. It would be a little self-serving and sort of self-congratulatory to beat up on people for what they were doing 500 or 300 or 1,000 years ago and be pretentious about what we know now and how little they knew then. It's interesting to think about what people did a long time ago because it tells us a lot about deeply seated human beliefs. One such incident and set of beliefs relates to transfusion. The first times that we're transfusing blood is in Paris, France, in the 1600s, when a doctor seizes a psychotic man off the streets and forces this man to undergo a blood transfusion in which the blood of a calf is transfused into his veins. This is in 1667 in Paris, because the doctor believes that the tranquil qualities of the personality of the calf will seep somehow into this man's veins and cure him of his problems, of his psychotic problems. Of course, it cures him of every problem. It kills him, because you can't transfuse the blood of an animal into a human being without probably killing that person. We know this now. We didn't know it then. And yes, in 50 years or 100 years, I'm sure people will be looking back at us with astonishment, thinking, what were they thinking in 2013 in the way they dealt with, say, leukemia or some other cancer or something? They'll have much more sophisticated approaches, and they'll be shaking their heads wondering what we were doing.
Lawrence Hill's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Blood, the Stuff of Life. Well, when you talk about, you know, people in the future saying what were they thinking in 2013, we can certainly pull the same maneuver with the folks, obviously, in 1667. But that's interesting, though, because here again, we're not talking about just conveying physical properties. We're talking about the qualities of the animal that were supposed to come along in this calf to human blood transfusion. This gentle, docile animal would then that animal's attributes would be carried in the blood.
Yes, that's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
And I think those basic ideas are still with us. We still imagine that blood and personality, blood and race, you know, blood and religion are deeply connected. And of course, sometimes those metaphors are beautiful. If you have a certain ethnicity or religion or racial background and you're proud of your family ancestry and you imagine that ancestry to be lodged metaphorically in your blood, and that makes you feel good about yourself and it gives you a way to go forward in the world with confidence and love and give to others, well, that's great. You know, if you can imagine blood in a healthy, positive way, that's great. And I do that, and I'm proud of my ancestry. We should all be proud of our respective ancestries. But when we take the metaphor of blood and we start alleging that some people have pure blood and others have impure blood, we, of course, will always be the ones with pure blood. It's the ones we don't like who will have impure blood, so therefore we should kill them. This often becomes the basis for genocide, whether it's the Spanish Inquisition during the medieval Spain period or the Holocaust or the Rwandan genocide or the war in the former Cambodia. Generally speaking, when humans have attacked others in a massive way, in the way of genocide, they've drawn on notions of blood impurity that justify their heinous crimes. So that takes us to the very far end of the spectrum of inhuman behavior that draws on notions of blood purity and impurity.
And the concept is so well known that even when it's applied in fiction, people know instantly what you're talking about. I was just thinking about the characters in the Harry Potter books who refer to the people of mixed blood as mudbloods.
Yes, and I find it fascinating that the two series of books that have been by far the most influential for young readers probably in the last century, you know, the Harry Potter series and the Twilight series, both turn on issues of blood purity. I'm less interested in the Twilight series because they're less well written and they're less profound, but they're about, you know, the purity of virginity and the purity of human blood versus that of a vampire and so forth. But the Harry Potter series are far more interesting, and I think they can be read in a way as kind of an allegory for the Holocaust. And in the whole series of Harry Potter is about whether or not people who believe that mixed blood witches disgraceful should be successful in their extermination campaign. We're really talking about an attempted Holocaust here. And Harry Potter and his cronies are standing up against those who wish to wipe out those who are of impure blood. So every child who's read Harry Potter has spent thousands of pages reading in a world that is obsessed with notions of blood purity.
Wow, that's deeper than I think I attached to when I read it myself. But when you think about the final book, for sure, a lot of it is in there. Lawrence Hill is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Blood, the Stuff of Life, considering blood as both the physical fluid and also as the metaphorical issue that that connects us as human beings, or keeps us apart for that matter. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, if you'd like to join the discussion. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lawrence Hill.
Good morning. I wonder if your book touches on in very much detail in a lot of the research that's been done over the last 30 to 50 years on women and blood, and especially in the terms of the ethnic groups, or even in the East as well as the West, various rituals that have gone down through centuries for entry into womanhood, your first period, menstrual blood and prohibitions around that, and then, of course, the blood with childbirth and the placenta and all that. So women seem incredibly tied to the concept of blood, and I wondered how you have dealt with that and some of the research that's been done over these last 50 years.
All right. Thanks for the call, Connie. Appreciate it. Lawrence, you did indeed get into that.
Thank you so much, Connie. I appreciate the question. It's funny because my wife warned me when I was thinking about writing this book that if I didn't write about the blood of women, I'd be in the doghouse because there's so much to say about women's blood and the ways in which men and women interpret their own blood differently that I'd be really ill-advised to ignore those issues and writing about them. So I did step into them as deeply as I could, and Well, there's so many ways to talk about it. I think that traditionally, stereotypically, men have viewed blood as a trophy of sport or war. Blood spilling is an accident. It's something that relates to your heroism, again, in sport or war. It's not supposed to be spilling from your body, and if it does, perhaps you're a hero. You've taken one for the team, so to speak, or for the nation. Women, of course, bleed monthly in their reproductive times of life, and they should be bleeding monthly unless they're pregnant. Bleeding monthly is a sign of their fertility and their health. And women, I think, have a profoundly different relationship to blood because they spill it monthly and they have to encounter it monthly. And I'm particularly interested in all the ways that men over the thousands of years have completely misunderstood and demonized women for the very spilling of their blood, all the ways we've held them back and judged them and isolated them because of blood spillage. So it does become a central preoccupation, certainly in the first chapter of the book. And thank you so much for asking the question.
And yet I'm surprised. I guess I knew instinctively from things I've read in the past that men certainly have some strange attitudes about women and menstruation. But some of the great thinkers of the modern world had some pretty wild theories on
absolutely. And I'll just mention one. Aristotle believed that women were inferior to men because, and again, I'm quoting Aristotle here, because he said that men's blood ran hotter than women's blood, and because women's blood wasn't hot enough, it was incapable of converting itself into semen, and he believed that blood converted itself into semen, and because women couldn't do this, he said, they had to expel their blood once a month, because what else were they to do with it? And therefore, he concluded, women's blood and women were inferior to men, and all sorts of classical Greek and male philosophers have failed the same test and have imagined women to be inferior and found out all sorts of preposterous theories, generated all sorts of preposterous theories about why women bled. And they never, of course, got it right. And it's, again, stunning to imagine this thinking going on for thousands of years.
Well, and that's the point, is that there are still societies that think some pretty strange things about menstruating women. What are some of the examples out there?
Well, gosh, there are still people who can't go to funerals, you know, if they're menstruating because a cultural practice will prevent them from doing so. Gosh, in the 1800s, I know that we're stepping back in time, but the British Medical Journal, one of the most well-respected medical journals on the planet, postulated that a menstruating woman could cause bacon to putrefy. Now, who on earth would come up with a theory like that, and how would they prove it? But they said so. women are judged in so many ways, whether they're considered apt for military duty, apt for certain jobs. Often the fear and lack of knowledge about menstruation has led men and others to bar women from access to equal opportunities in the world. So it still goes on, I think, profoundly in many ways today in 2013.
Chapter 2 in your book is Blood and Truth, Honesty and Morality. You start talking about Paula Findlay, the Canadian triathlete. Start with her worst day. What happened to her?
Oh, my. The worst way in this poor woman's life was during the London Olympics in 2012. Paula Findlay was a Canadian triathlete. She had been ranked number one in the world in the triathlon, which, of course, involves an extremely demanding combination of swimming, cycling, and running over a long distance. And she went into the race as a medal favorite. She certainly was expected by many Canadians to at least finish on the podium. But in the London Olympics, she finished dead last, and she was lapped by many of her competitors in the final stage of the triathlon, which was a run four times around a 2.5-kilometer track. And of course, she finished the race in tears and staggering and exhausted and terribly distraught. And nobody could understand why a person who was expected to win possibly the Olympic triathlon should finish dead last, be lapped by her competitors. As it turned out, blood tests revealed after the fact that she was severely anemic and had gone into the race unbeknownst to her severely anemic. Well, asking an Olympic athlete to race against the fastest athletes in the world with anemia is sort of like asking that person to enter the race one-legged. There's just no possibility of winning if your blood isn't efficient. Hugely significant in endurance sport is the effective transfer of oxygen from the blood to the cells. So if you're not doing that because you're anemic, you have no chance of winning against the best athletes in the world. And it was so interesting to me because we imagine competitive athletes to be successful because of their strong hamstrings or their big biceps, you know, or the force of their will. But a lot of it comes down to the strength of their blood.
And you had an episode of this that you relate in the book as well, where you, a portion of your life where you were dedicated to becoming a great athlete, but your blood really got in the way, didn't it?
Yes, I had hoped to become an Olympic athlete myself. I had dreams of winning the Olympic 5,000 meters and had figured out all the different ways that I would win this race. Of course, this is when I was 12, 13, 15 years old. I trained very seriously. I trained twice a day, maniacally for years, pursuing the dream of being an Olympic athlete, but I never even was able to win, say, a City of Toronto championship or some relatively minor championship in the distance races. And finally, I had my own blood tested, and we discovered that although I was training very intensely and was very, very fit, I sort of, as a 15 or 16-year-old, I had the lung capacity of a 45-year-old smoker because I just didn't transfer oxygen well at all from my blood to my tissues. And so I was sort of held back by my own physical disabilities, let's say, or lack of excellence at the very least. So I continue to run and stay fit and love to do so, but I learned that there are limits to one's body.
Well, and then here we begin to move away from the body and more off into the metaphorical ideas about blood as you move through this section of the book. But I guess where I'm struck dealing with ancient societies where some sort of blood sacrifice, whether from animal or human, was required, is whence comes the idea that the gods wanted blood?
I'm not sure when. I'm not going to pretend to know when, like how many thousands of years ago, the first time a first human being believes that their gods are telling them that they must spill blood. I don't know the answer to that, and I won't pretend to know exactly when. But we do know, and I know, that for thousands of years, human beings have believed in various times and cultures and places, not just in one culture or one place, that one had to satisfy or placate the gods by spilling blood. Spilling one's own blood was a sign of one's fealty, one's loyalty to God. It was a way of ensuring that the sun would rise the next day and the rain would fall and the crops would grow and that we would be okay. And so for a long, long time, we sacrificed blood. We killed human beings. We killed, you know, our first sons. Of course, the story in the Old Testament of Abraham and Isaac is a classic example of that. The father is climbing up the mountain to slay his son to satisfy God, in this story in the Old Testament tells us really that this is a time in which we finally are told, supposedly by God, that it's no longer necessary to slay one's first son to sort of satisfy God, that the ending of human sacrifice is marked by this story of Abraham and Isaac. So it's a long, it goes back a long way in many, many cultures, not just in one.
Well, I guess what happened then was we realized the value of blood to us and figured that any deities would attach the same importance to it.
Yes, and of course it's not good enough to drop a leaf or to, you know, kill a piglet or something. Not enough pain and suffering is involved. Somehow the notion of loss, truly losing something like your own child, is necessary in old-fashioned thinking, at least to satisfy the gods. It has to be a great painful loss.
Now, the book is called Blood, the Stuff of Life. Lawrence Hill, its author, our guest. We'll come back and talk more with Lawrence and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Canadian journalist and author Lawrence Hill. His ninth book is about blood, blood as physical fluid, blood as major metaphor and connector of civilizations. The book is called Blood, the Stuff of Life. Lawrence Hill, our guest. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You write about, when we talking in this section of the book about the spilling of blood and the value either to gods or to other human beings, you write that the stories of women spilling blood loom larger in the imagination. Why is that, Lawrence?
Oh, I think what I was referring to, if I'm remembering correctly, your reference is the idea that, oddly, we seem in society much more upset if a woman spills blood criminally, you know, goes on some homicidal binge and kills other people, than we do if a man does. Obviously, it's news if a murder happens in our city, but if a woman carries out murder, it's bigger news. It disturbs us more. And I think it's because we have these set notions of what women are and are not supposed to do, and we think often that they're not supposed to be, you know, homicidally blood-spilling, violent creatures. We like to think of them stereotypically as being nurturing creatures. So if a woman does become violently criminal, it upsets us more and it sets us off, and media react much more viscerally to a woman carrying out a major murder spree than say they would to a man.
Letting us take a call for you, here is Jerry in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lawrence Hill.
I was calling to confirm, as I hope, that Lawrence Hill was also the author of an earlier book called Someone Knows My Name. Is that the case?
Yes, I thank you. Yes, I am the author of Someone Knows My Name.
Well, I thank you. I have to go in the opposite direction. What a marvelous, marvelous book you wrote. We read it here at a book club, and everybody loved it. In our experience, it's hard enough for a male author to create a real flesh and blood male character, and a female author to do the same with a female character, but you created such a marvelous woman character, so believable, and the story you put her through was so fascinating that it's one of our very special books.
Thank you so much. Well, perhaps one day I'll have a chance to communicate with your book club about that. That's really touching to hear. What part of the States are you in again?
We are right outside where you are now. We're in Rogue Valley in Talent.
I see.
Yeah. So well, he's not in the studio with me. He's on the phone. But all right. So just north of Ashland, the place is called Talent,
right.
Oregon.
I see. My goodness. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear you were touched by the novel. And as you know, there's some blood in that novel too. The issues of menstruation during the theft of children from slavery in West Africa. Children who are becoming young women who are bleeding even as they walked to the coast to be abducted into the slave trade in the New World. These are issues that loom large in that novel as well. So thank you so much for mentioning it. I'm glad the book touched you.
And Jerry, thanks for the call. Very much appreciate it. So getting back to the content of Blood, the Stuff of Life, though, there are just too many stories to actually fit into an hour of radio here, but I want to talk about Charles Drew, the accomplished doctor.
Yes.
And in his story and about blood donations and what his attempts to do were.
Well, Charles Drew was an African-American who was born, just before the turn of the century, who studied medicine at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, but was an African-American, a light-skinned, very light-skinned African-American. He could have quote-unquote passed for white had he chosen, but he was deeply lodged in his culture and in his people, so he never sought to pass for white. And he becomes one of the world's leading plasma specialists. And in the early days of the Second World War, before the states have joined the war, but while Britain and Canada are already in it, the United States is shipping plasma to Britain to help its allies in the early stages of the war. And Charles Drew is responsible for coming up with a system for the safe storage and preservation and shipping of plasma from the U.S. to its allies in Great Britain. When America joins the war, rules are enacted that prevent black people from donating their blood to whites. Blood bags are to be marked C for colored and W for white. And hideous as this might be to imagine, not only were human beings segregated in the time of the Second World War, and of course before and after, my father, being an African-American soldier in the American forces in the Second World War, lived out his military life as a segregated soldier, but not only were humans segregated, but so was their blood. Charles Drew and other scientists of the day knew perfectly well that there's no difference between so-called black and so-called white blood. They knew completely that the only thing that mattered on the battlefield when people are bleeding to death was, were they getting blood types that matched? Was the injured soldier on the battlefield getting the same blood type as the type he was losing? Would that keep him alive, or would an unsafe transfusion kill him? That's what mattered, not race. And even though we understood fully that blood had nothing to do with race, even in 1941, 42, 43, rules were still passed preventing blacks from donating to whites. And these rules were not based on medicine or science, but were based on fear and social policies. So we had fear and social policies interfering with science and medicine and sort of skewing policies of the politics of blood donation.
So at any point, did any soldier die, perhaps, because nobody would give them a blood transfusion across color lines?
Well, I'm sure many soldiers died because they weren't getting blood quickly enough. I don't know the details of individual cases of soldiers dying, but it was a hugely discriminatory act that would have affected people, not just soldiers, but other Americans who were injured in hospitals and the like, who needed blood quickly. There were instances of doctors rebelling against the system and switching blood bags and taking blood that was badly needed and changing the marking from C to C for colored to W for white so that they could go ahead and give it anyway. So there are cases of people playing with it or subverting the system. But Charles Drew spoke very vehemently against this policy, which insulted African Americans. African Americans were very hurt by these decisions. They wanted to serve their country at war, and they wanted to serve also their citizens by donating blood, just like any other loyal American would. Charles Drew, sadly, died in a car accident in 1950. He was head of surgery at Howard University. He was driving south to Alabama to take part in a free medical clinic, and he fell asleep at the wheel in North Carolina, flipped his car, and bled to death. And for many years, sort of an urban rumor circulated in the United States and Canada that he bled to death because the hospital wouldn't treat him because he was a black man, you know, in North Carolina at the time. But it's not true. He was treated vigorously, but he was so severely injured that he sadly died. But nonetheless, this urban myth sort of took hold, and many people believed it for many, many years. But it's quite a story, quite a sad story, that one of the leading plasma specialists of the world, who was black, should die of blood loss in a car accident after arguing that blacks should have the right to give their blood to others, you know, during the war.
Yeah, that is an amazing irony there. Let's talk about tainted blood and issues with blood donations over the years. I was surprised to read in your book about what happened to the Red Cross in Canada.
Yes, well, around 1983, when the AIDS crisis is coming into full bloom in the world, certain tainted bloods enter blood supplies, and hemophiliacs and other people who are receiving donated blood to stay alive suddenly start getting tainted blood in their veins and dying, or getting ill with hepatitis C, getting terrible, terrible illnesses, or dying by the thousands. And this tainted blood scandal rocks the world. Canada was profoundly affected by a tainted blood scandal, but so were other countries, the United States, France, Japan, the UK. This was a scandal and an issue having to do with the safety of blood that affected countries around the world. Canada was profoundly affected. It probably the greatest public health scandal we've had in Canada in the 20th century. As a result of this, of course, we became very fearful about what would constitute a safe blood to be donated and what would be unsafe. So rules were passed that made it impossible for gay men to donate blood. That no longer were gay men allowed to donate blood after this scandal arose. It was understandable at the time. This was in the early 80s, and we didn't even know in 82 or 83 how AIDS was transmitted. We didn't even have a word for what we now know to be HIV. So we were at the early stages of understanding. But since that time, our blood donation technologies have progressed by light years, and we know much more. We know how to test blood. We know what question to ask. And most experts who are involved with blood in the science of blood, you know, understand that there's no need now to prevent sexually active gay men from donating blood. There are ways to make sure if an individual donor is safe or is not safe through questions and interviews, but also through testing their blood before it's drawn into the bloodstream to be given to other people. So I would argue that the same sort of discriminatory policies that made it impossible for blacks to donate during the Second World War now apply to gays. And most developed nations of the world have rules barring donations of that nature. Even the American Medical Association argues that these bans should be lifted. So even a fairly conservative body, you know, believes that the bans is ready for them to go. So I think that in the next 10 or so years, I would bet you that in the United States and in Canada, we will change our blood donation rules to bring them in line with science and medicine.
But in the United States at this point, you cannot be a gay man and a blood donor?
That's correct.
Wow.
Sexually active, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So if you're celibate, you can donate blood.
Well, actually, if you state yourself to be gay, you cannot donate blood, you know, if you're a gay male in the States. In Canada, they've introduced this ridiculous rule in the last several months that you can donate blood if you're a gay man if you say that you've been celibate for 5 years. So who does that draw into the midst of blood donors? It's sort of like a typical ridiculous Canadian compromise. It doesn't really change anything. But I do believe that, you know, serious, you know, hematologists and physicians are recommending that these bans be lifted. And over time, I think we will bring our policies in line with science and medicine.
Chapter 3 in the book, Blood, the Stuff of Life, deals with you traveling to Africa to find your roots there. And this was a process that was derailed by illness. What happened to you?
I went to work as a volunteer 3 times in various French-speaking West African countries when I was a young man. I went with a charitable nonprofit group called Crossroads International, which actually began in the States but spread to Canada. And in my first trip, I went to Niger, which is in West Africa. It's a landlocked country, often described as one of the 3 poorest countries in the world. And I found as I was in the country that I really wanted to connect with my roots. I was so excited as a Canadian of African heritage to be among African peoples. And I'd grown up in white suburbs with a fairly light skin. And so I this was my opportunity, I felt, as a very young man to finally connect with my kind of my ancient peoples, and I wanted to be recognized and seen for my heritage. It was sort of sprang out of me. But in the early days that I was there, I fell very, very ill and developed the gastroenteritis and severe anemia myself through drinking bad water, and had to be hospitalized. The hospitalization saved my life, and I needed several blood transfusions to stay alive. And as this blood was coming into my veins, this is 1979, I sort of wondered, looking at these shrinking blood bags hanging above me, was I receiving African blood, and did this make me more African? Was I receiving European blood, and did that thus make me more white? Of course, ultimately, I understood that what really mattered, the only thing that mattered, was that the blood I was receiving was safe, and that it matched my blood type, and that the blood type of the donor had to be the same as mine. the incident changed me forever, and I sort of emerged from the hospital forever calm and no longer worried about how people might or might not see my own ancestry, accepting much more deeply the various strands of my own ancestry. We all have various strands of our ancestry, or most of us, many different parts of our families from many different places. So I just emerged from that glad to be alive and much, much, much calmer about who I was and no longer fretting about what people saw in my own individual blood, so to speak.
But it sounds like for many of us, then, the default position is to think that characteristics are conveyed by blood. The whole statement, it's in the blood, still resonates, it sounds like, across many, many cultures and societies.
Absolutely. It's in the blood. If you have bad blood, nobody should marry into you because everybody knows you're a disreputable character. If you're a blue blood or have royal blood, then perhaps people will agree to keep paying taxes in England to keep you in Buckingham Palace as king or queen. If you're a cold-blooded murderer, really you're not human at all, but your blood is likened to that of a reptile. There are so many ways that blood creeps into our language. It's hard to have a conversation for an hour with a friend without having that conversation taken over by metaphors of blood, even if you're not really fully aware of it. So blood is lodged in our language, it's lodged in our imaginations, it's lodged in our most despicable acts, such as genocide. It's deeply lodged in how we see ourselves as men and women, and it also informs our notions of race.
All right, there's so much to think about. And in fact, I guess at times in your life, you were wondering if talent was conveyed through the blood. Your brother is Dan Hill of Sometimes When We Touch fame?
Yes, that's right. He's a famous singer-songwriter. And my father was well-known in Canada as a human rights pioneer in Canada, born in the States, as was my mother, but came to Canada the day after they married as a black couple, black and white couple, but meaning my father was black and mother white. But yes, I think many people associate talent with blood, and they imagine that if your father or mother was great at the violin or the guitar or singing or in politics, then perhaps you should be too because it's in your blood, which is, I think, a deeply troubling concept. You know, talent and the ability to lead nations isn't lodged in your red corpuscles.
No, it's but that's what the book is good about. It's making us think about things like that and all the concepts that we carry along with the blood that they don't really have a direct connection to it. Blood, the stuff of life, is the book. Lawrence Hill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Pleasure. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about the bees and pesticides. We'll talk in our Vents Day segment about filibusters and fracking. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk about the JFK assassination anniversary. Jeff Golden will be here to talk about his novel on JFK living called Unafraid. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Producer Charlotte Duran, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.